Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.
It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And it is time for another classic episode of Tech Stuff. And you know what? I know you guys think when I'm doing these that I'm just sort of gliding along. So what better topic to cover than flying without fuel? What could that mean? Well, let's find out. We wanted to have a chance to chat about something that I talked about in a recent episode of Forward Thinking. So if you guys haven't checked out Forward Thinking, please do. I think a lot of Tech Stuff fans would really enjoy that series. Joe is the head writer on Forward Thinking and has done amazing work.
I have not written this episode, however. This episode was, I thought, really cool, and it's about a solar-powered aircraft.
Yeah, which, when you think about it, that on its face sounds pretty crazy, especially if you have taken time to really look into solar power and not just its advantages, but its limitations, right?
Right. Well, this is obviously not the only solar-powered aircraft that's ever been created, but
right,
it's probably the coolest one and ever created yet. And it is amazing that you can take a huge, heavy thing off the ground with the power of solar energy alone. That's just, I mean, this is what powers your calculator.
Right.
Not an airplane.
Yeah. Like, for example, I have a battery pack in my backpack. It's got a little solar panel that it faces outward. And in theory, you can use solar energy to recharge the battery pack, which then you can use to recharge something like a smartphone, right? That's the basic premise of this backpack. Here's the thing. If I want to recharge that battery using solar power, I have to have it in the sun for 12 consecutive hours. Well, it doesn't have to be consecutive, but 12 hours to get a full charge. Whereas if I were to plug it into the wall, it's an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours total to charge it all the way up, maybe even less than that. So it just shows that solar power, you know, getting a lot of energy from it is a challenge. Now, obviously, the solar panel that's in my backpack is not what you would consider bleeding edge.
No, it's probably not the best that our current science has to offer.
It's probably not even on the top, near the top line for consumer tech right now, because what's available on the consumer side is a big drop down from the cutting edge best of the best. So if you are getting a solar panel that has been designed to be as efficient as possible. We're talking top of the line. This is the stuff that NASA is going to use, right? You're going to top out somewhere around 40 to 41% efficiency.
And what you're talking about there is how much of the energy from the sun you're converting.
Right.
So you're not even starting necessarily with a very high number. It's just how much of that solar energy is arriving at the panels, which is obviously going to be less than, say, the energy density of gasoline or something like that.
Far less, far less. Yeah. So you're getting this, you're losing 60% of the energy that hits the panel right off the bat. Then that ends up being converted into electricity, and it's not that much per solar panel. Like, an individual solar panel doesn't put out that much electricity. Even if it's really efficient, it's not putting out that much. That's why whenever you talk about really using solar panels effectively, you're talking about lots and lots and lots of solar panels, right? They have individual solar cells in them, and there might be thousands of these solar cells in one solar panel farm.
Yeah, and if you're designing an airplane that's powered by solar panels, one of the big questions I would wonder is, where are you going to put them? I mean, when I heard about this thing, before I saw an image of it, what I pictured in my mind was like a football field sized flat surface with just a tiny little, you know, person strapped to the bottom of it.
And that's not that far off in a way.
That probably wouldn't fly, but
you
have to design it like a plane.
Yeah. You got to have a lot of surface area, right?
Yeah.
You have to have a lot of surface area for multiple reasons. So the big reasons why you need a lot of surface area, which in planes means a wide wingspan, because obviously if you made the fuselage or the body of the plane the biggest part, then you have to figure out how do you get something that bulky and heavy into the air and have the vehicle maintain enough thrust to keep it in the air. Because, I mean, thrust is a really important part of this too. We just established that solar panels aren't generating that much electricity, so they can't push a super powerful electric motor. And the electric motor is what's going to be turning the propellers that are going to provide the thrust necessary to get this plane in the air. So you have to keep weight in mind. You can't make it too heavy. And you still need all that surface area. So what do you do? Well, what the folks over at Solar Impulse.
Oh, yeah. We should have said that's the one we're talking about today. The Solar Impulse 2.
Solar Impulse 2 is specifically the one we're talking about. There already has been a Solar Impulse 1, which was kind of a proof of concept vehicle that they built in order to test out the different engineering approaches they were going to take, because their goal is to have this this Solar Impulse 2 go all the way around the Earth.
I believe the demo of the Solar Impulse 1 was a transcontinental flight.
Yeah.
Right. It was from the West Coast of the United States to the East Coast.
And they had several legs of the journey. They even had set a record for the longest the most number of flight hours consecutively for a manned solar powered aircraft. So if you're talking about unmanned aircraft, you end up having really long times because you don't have a human that you have to.
You don't need a cabin.
Yeah, you don't need to worry about a person saying goodbye to their family for 2 weeks or whatever. So for the manned record, we're talking 26 hours, 10 minutes, and 19 seconds. So more than a full day. And if you're thinking solar power and you're thinking, how the heck were they able to fly when there was no sun? We'll get to that. So the record's already been set. These were all proof of concepts that they were saying, well, we need to figure out what things are required for this dream of flying a solar-powered aircraft all the way around the world. What's required for that to actually become a reality? So this wingspan was the first thing, and the Solar Impulse 2's wingspan is pretty impressive. We're talking about 72 meters. So that's more than 240 feet. We're talking about the width that's greater than, say, a Boeing 747-81.
Okay, but unlike a Boeing 747-81, it doesn't have a huge fuselage full of passengers and cargo.
Right.
It has a tiny, tiny little
compartment.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's essentially the body of the plane is very small. It'll allow the pilot and co-pilot to sit side by side, just as in a traditional, aircraft. And it's not, you know, front and back like the old World War I and World War II aircraft were.
As a ball turret.
Yeah, no, not going to have to worry about that. It's relatively small, and it's made out of carbon fiber. So carbon fiber has a couple of advantages, right? It's pretty strong, and it's really light compared to other materials. So you want to use something that's going to be resilient so it can withstand the rigors of air travel. And
right.
yet it can't be too heavy. So carbon fiber is what they went with. And in fact, the entire plane ends up being something like, I think it's 2,300 kilograms. So that's around 5,070 pounds. That means that there are cars on the market that are heavier than this airplane is. This airplane that has a wingspan wider than a Boeing 747.
That's pretty crazy.
It's pretty crazy.
You know, I would imagine one reason that they can use those kind of fibers is because this airplane goes a lot slower than
yeah.
your standard passenger airplane,
right.
which obviously the faster you go, the more turbulence and friction you're going to have to withstand.
Right. And, so with a Boeing example, for example, like your average commuter airline type of thing, you're talking about speeds in the 500 mile per hour range. With Solar Impulse 2, you're not going to go quite that fast. The top speed is something like 88 miles per hour.
88 miles per hour.
Fortunately, it does not require 1.21 gigawatts for it to fly, or else it would go back.
How many gigawatts does it require?
Not many at all, really. Because, again, do you know how many solar panels are actually on this
thing? No, I don't know.
17,000. Across that 72.
I guess I don't know what that means because I don't know how big they are.
They're not, it's not that they're that big. Well, I mean, think of a 72 meter wide wingspan.
Yeah.
That's pretty huge. It's not that the panels themselves or the solar cells, I guess I should say, it's not that the solar cells are that big because really 17,000 solar cells is more accurate than panels. Panels are like a collection of cells, but they're not that big. But the fact that there are 17,000 of them is pretty impressive. And they're only driving 4 electric motors. And like I said, those electric motors turn electric propellers. The propellers are shaped in such a way to help provide the thrust needed so that you maintain the speed to stay in the air. Those wide wings also are able to provide a lot of lift and stability in flight. Although it is kind of tricky. You can't take off in windy conditions with this thing. You would imagine not, because with such a wide wingspan, a little bit of wind could easily get it to start tilting any which way.
Yeah, yet another thing I'd also imagine is that the wider wingspan allows it to stay aloft at lower speeds.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another thing. And it's also not going to go to the same sort of altitude that you would see with like a commuter jet or something. That's not going to go up to 35,000 feet. Well, I've been cruising without fuel for a while now. I think I'll just keep on going. But you folks out there, you look like you could use a little bit of a break. So we'll be right back. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Okay, so we're doing a round-the-world flight. It's at 88 miles per hour. That means at top speed, 88 miles per hour. That's not average speed. That's top speed. That would mean there's going to be some stretches of this flight where the airplane's going to have to stay in the air a really long time because there's no convenient way to land it at night when you're over, say, the ocean, right? There are going to be times where the, you know, those oceans are so wide, there's no way the plane can make a trip across, say, the Atlantic in a single day, not at 88 miles per hour. It's going to take multiple days and nights of flying for it to get from one point to another where it can safely land. Because they do plan on taking this trip through several legs where the plane will be able to land, maintenance crews can come out and do some repairs if necessary, that kind of thing. It's not like it's going to do a full flight around the Earth without ever touching down. They will be touching down along the way and then taking back off in another leg of the journey. But still, when you're over the ocean, you don't have that luxury. So you've got to be able to fly at night.
So that's when they switch to monkey on a stationary bicycle power.
You know, I recommended that. I thought its time has come. I mean, it's an unproven technology, I'll grant you. But I really think we have not tapped the potential of monkey bicycles.
No, I think this is, they've got to be using some pretty good batteries.
Yeah.
And that has to be a very important part of the design, right? Because batteries are heavy.
Exactly.
And this airplane needs to be light.
Yeah, they used, they created lithium batteries. They actually had, the engineers had to look at a way to make the batteries incredibly efficient, and they had to be able to charge quickly, because if you aren't getting a full charge throughout the day, then while you're also driving those propellers, then that could become a problem at night, right? If you want to remain aloft, that could be a serious problem.
Yeah.
So they experiment with different electrolytes, which, of course, as we know from Idiocracy, is the stuff that plants crave. But they experiment with a lot of different chemical compositions to try and make the most efficient batteries. So they went with lithium batteries that are kind of, think of it like a long, thin, almost like a film, as opposed to a big battery pack.
Okay.
So it's pretty remarkable, the design. And the batteries weigh 633 kilograms, or about 2,077 pounds, which means that, you know, they weigh a little bit more than a quarter of the actual plane itself, the batteries alone.
Wow.
So obviously batteries are heavy. They're important because you have to have that energy to tap into at night. Otherwise, once the sun starts to go down or it gets too cloudy, your plane would plummet.
And this isn't just a problem for planes. I mean, it's especially a problem in planes, but
right.
This is a problem for any electric vehicle, right? Is how to deal with this massive battery that's required to operate motors with this kind of power.
Exactly. And it's something that we've seen not just in electric vehicles, but electronics in general. We have a little bit more to say about this interesting episode, but before we get to that, let's take another quick break. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
The processing power has increased steadily over the years. We've got the whole observation of Moore's Law, where we're seeing it practically double every 2 years or so, depending upon your interpretation of the observation. Well, then why haven't batteries kept pace with that? You know, I'm seeing my mobile device is getting more powerful, but the battery's draining faster, so it's not as useful to me as long. And part of that is just because batteries aren't on that accelerated path. I mean, there's only so much we can do with chemistry.
To be fair, they have come a long way. This is also a topic we talked about not too long ago on Forward Thinking, is how far batteries have come.
Sure.
It is kind of amazing what we've achieved today. I mean, your standard lithium ion battery today is kind of a wonder work.
It really is. Yeah. The fact that you're able to recharge it so that the electrochemical reaction that's going on within the battery gives off electrons. I mean, that's the whole point of a battery. Otherwise, it would be useless. And in an alkaline battery, this is an irreversible, reaction. So the electrochemical reaction happens, electrons are given off as a result, you can use those electrons to do work, thus electricity. But once it's drained, once that chemical reaction is gone to a certain point, you're not generating enough electrons for it to be useful anymore, you have a dead battery.
Yeah.
Whereas with these lithium rechargeable batteries, there are non-rechargeable types too, but with rechargeable batteries, you can reverse that reaction by essentially forcing electrons backward through that pathway.
It's basically doing the whole thing backward. You're putting work into the battery the same way you took work out of it earlier.
Yeah. So the fact that we've managed to do that and increase the efficiency, even a little bit, is the reason why something like the Solar Impulse 2 is possible. And again, we're not going to see this actually fly around the world until 2015, but they've already proven that it works with that first proof of concept vehicle that was able to stay up in the air for 26 hours. The fact that it was able to recharge the batteries, fly all the way through the night and continue, you know, they're fully certified to fly at night. It shows that there's been a lot of work done here. So we've got, the energy side covered. The fact that it's going to be using solar power to drive the electric motors at day, switch to battery at night. It's going to be able to fly really for as long as the pilot and co-pilot can stand.
That was my question.
Yeah.
What's this going to be like for the pilot and co-pilot?
Okay. Have you ever, Joe, have you ever traveled first class?
Oh, no.
So I've traveled first class, not to brag, but it's pretty sweet. And once you travel first class.
How was the champagne and cheese selection?
We didn't have champagne. We had real pain. Thank you. None of this champagne you guys talk about. But I mean, anyone who's traveled first or business class and then goes back to travel coach, the belly aching is unbearable, right? It's just this idea. Oh, no.
Can't go back.
Yeah. You can't go back. By the way, I haven't traveled first or business in years. And frankly, I'm still amazed that planes work. So I'm happy either way. but there was a period shortly after that time where I was able to travel first or business where I was one of those unbearable people for that particular reason. I'm unbearable for many other reasons now, but for that particular reason where I can't believe this.
What a wonderful frequency of complaining.
I know. Flying coach, though, would seem like an amazing luxury compared to what the pilot and co-pilot are going to have to be able to endure to make this round the world flight a possibility. Because one of the things they're going to have to do, like I said, is stay in the air for some of the estimates are as long as 5 days and nights, or perhaps even longer for just one leg of this journey. So for 5 days and nights, you are in a chair in a plane and you cannot go anywhere because there's no space. Every single ounce matters on that plane. Every single inch counts. So there's no space in the back for one person to go and collapse while the other one flies the plane. Instead, their chairs are going to be designed in such a way where they can lay back into a cot form, and you can, the plane's going to have an autopilot. So they can set their heading and course and both catch some Z's while they need to, and then wake up and everything should be fine.
Somehow I don't suspect that will happen.
Well,
sounds freaky.
I think it's probably more likely that they're going to do their best to take shifts. But the nice thing is that they can set it on autopilot and catch some rest if they need to. But all right. So we've got laying down to rest and we've got sitting up to operate, but there's still one important human activity besides the whole eating and drinking thing. They'll obviously have some food and water up there on the plane as well. There's one other important activity that we can't avoid.
Yeah, I was about to ask, have the engineers factored into the plane's course the fact that it might be losing a bit of mass as it travels?
So what we're alluding to is, where do you poop? I mean, you know, it's one of the most popular questions on How Stuff Works' main site is, you know,
where do you poop?
In space.
Oh, okay.
All about space toilets. In this case, those fancy chairs I was talking about, they double up as both chairs and cots. Well, really, they do triple duty because they're also lavatories. I had to do it, Joe. Joe is rolling his eyes. So everybody.
I know we've already achieved some horrible pun hat trick.
Everybody who misses Lauren's eye rolling, just know that her spirit is living in Joe right now, even though Lauren herself is not in the office.
Possessed.
But no, it's true. The actual chairs are going to do this triple job of being the place where you sit, the place where you sleep, and the place where you have to go to the bathroom, because they couldn't incorporate a separate lavatory because, again, every single bit of weight counts.
It seems like there would be ventilation issues.
I haven't actually seen any illustrations or animations of how this actually works. Like, does a little bit of the bottom of the chair just open up to the elements?
The ocean.
I mean, who knows? I honestly do not know the answer to that because I haven't seen the illustrations. I've seen footage of them testing out the chairs, laying it back into cot form, but not the pooping.
Well, here's a question I don't know if you know the answer to.
Sure.
Is the cabin pressurized? Are they flying at such an altitude that they don't have to pressurize the cabin?
Now, the pictures I've seen them wearing, essentially, air masks as well.
Okay.
So I would imagine that the cabin is not pressurized, but I also imagine they're not typically flying at an altitude where that's too much of a problem. They did, as I saw, have masks there, because I saw a guy who essentially, he pulls the mask aside in order to eat a little snack cake, drink a little water, put the mask back on, go on his merry way. But whether or not the whole thing is pressurized, I don't think it is. Because again, that would require a lot of weight to be able to put in the systems necessary. You have to seal everything off, obviously, because if you don't seal everything off, you can't maintain a pressure. You know, it would just be escaping the whole time. Plus, then you would have to have the mechanisms necessary to pressurize the cabin, and all of that adds weight. So really, when it comes to solar aircraft in general, not just the Solar Impulse, but any solar aircraft, anything that's not absolutely necessary to maintain flight tends to be left behind. So you don't have a lot of the systems and a lot of the other niceties. In fact, a lot of solar aircraft don't even have landing gear. They have wheels that allow them to roll around when they're before they take off. But then once they take off, they jettison the wheels because that's weight.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's like the fuel containers on the space shuttle.
Yeah. So it means that when you're landing, you're not so much landing as you are having as controlled a crash as you possibly can, which I'm sure is nerve-wracking, but that's part of the design. So the plane is designed to have that kind of landing. It's not, you know, an emergency type thing. This is standard operating procedure on board solar aircraft. And, it's kind of, I'm curious to see really how this continues to develop, what the experience ends up really being like for the pilot and co-pilot, whether or not they're able to make this. By the way, I didn't mention this, their plan for the entire journey, you know, we're talking about that 88 miles per hour top speed. It's going to take them 5 months to go all the way around the world. And that's in various legs of the journey. So it's going to be lots of stopping and starting, but 5 months total. So it's not something that's going to take place super fast, obviously, but I'm really curious to see if they're able to make it all the way around the world. And one of the things I love about this is that it's really a pure engineering challenge. Right?
Yeah,
the whole thing was this idea of let's build a heavier than air aircraft only powered by solar energy. The batteries are charged by solar energy. So that's how you can say that it's only powered by solar energy and be able to fly it all the way around the world. All right. That's our goal. How do we achieve that? And honestly, when they first started thinking about this, they started talking about it back in 1999. When they first started thinking about it, it was not something that could have been achieved just based upon the technology they had at their disposal. The team had to innovate and invent things and tweak stuff in order for this to happen. And that's what I find so exciting, because it's one of those projects where even if you think it's a ridiculous endeavor to fly around the world in a solar powered aircraft, the truth is the work that they're doing can inform other industries and other technologies that end up benefiting us in the long run.
Yeah, well, before I read about this particular story, I would have thought a solar-powered aircraft was just impossible.
Right.
That there's no way you can generate enough power to create the thrust you need to stay aloft in a heavier-than-air aircraft. I mean,
right.
Obviously, if you have a balloon or something, but...
Right.
Yeah, and so it just blows my mind that they can do this at all, to mention the extent to which they're taking this technology. We should talk about how this is... almost certainly not going to be the passenger plane of the future.
No, there's no way. Because I think all the reasons that we gave of what they had to do in order to make this possible,
right.
I'm pretty sure that your average frequent flyer doesn't want to poop in their chair.
Right.
That would be a big one.
Well, and you can't get enough people on it.
Yeah.
It doesn't go fast enough.
You can't pressurize it.
Yeah.
Or at least that's what I assume. I could be wrong about that. I didn't see anything about pressurization on, about the Solar Impulse. If I'm wrong about that, that's fascinating. I would want to read more about that, how they achieved that.
Right.
Using this lightweight approach. But.
Well, even if you table that one,
yeah,
I mean, all the other concerns make this is not going to replace the passenger jet.
No. What it could do is you could take a look at all the different considerations the team made in order to make the aircraft as efficient as it possibly can. And some of those lessons you might be able to apply to aircraft design in the future.
Yeah. And I would think one thing to focus on, or at least for us to remember, is that the advances that come with this kind of aircraft that are really important to future aircraft that people might fly in are not necessarily like the solar panels,
right,
or the solar implementation. It might be the ways that aircraft like this use clever tricks to become lighter and still,
right,
have enough stability in the fuselage not to come apart.
Right. Yeah. Because one of the things, you know, one of the big reasons why this is so important is that we didn't really address this, but air travel generates a lot of pollution, right?
Oh, yeah.
Your standard jet, like your standard commercial jet, can create as much as 0.4 to 0.65 pounds of greenhouse gas per mile traveled. It all depends on the destination. And paradoxically, perhaps, the further you go, the less you're generating per mile. But the reason for that is because takeoff and landing are where you generate the most greenhouse gases because they require the most power.
Yeah, there are people who talk about buying carbon offset credits.
Yeah.
When you take an air travel journey, that's not a bad idea, even though through air travel, it's not necessarily just carbon emissions, it's other greenhouse gas emissions.
Nitrous oxide
might be
and
even
methane.
More prevalent in jet fuel exhaust.
Yep. But I mean, it's a huge amount. Like you're talking, you know, 0.4 to 0.65 pounds of greenhouse gases. I mean, I don't know if you've weighed a gas recently, but it takes a lot for it to make a pound. So you're talking about a truly massive amount of greenhouse gases every time an aircraft is flying. And again, depending on the type of aircraft and how far it's going, that's what tells you how much average you are generating. So if we're able to take lessons from things like the Solar Impulse 2 aircraft and incorporate them into future aircraft design so that our aircrafts are more efficient and using less fuel, then we are having a smaller negative impact on the environment overall.
Yeah, and while, as we said, there's probably not going to be a solely solar-powered aircraft, there may be hybrid aircraft in the future for
sure.
Standard commuters.
Right. And, you know, you can see the possibility of using solar power for things other than the thrust, right? You could use solar panels to do things like help power some of the various systems aboard the aircraft, depending upon what kind of aircraft it is. I mean, you probably don't want all the avionics powered by solar power, but things like cabin lighting, that kind of stuff could certainly be augmented through solar power, probably in a more analogous way to the way the Solar Impulse has batteries. You would probably use the solar power to charge batteries, and then the systems would draw electricity from the batteries, not have a direct line solar panel to system, because that wouldn't be as useful in you know all the different situations that aircraft go in. Other thing about to keep in mind is that aircraft tend to fly higher than your regular cloud level. Commercial aircraft do, so they actually have better access to sunlight than something that can't go that high. And also we're seeing this technology being incorporated into unmanned aerial vehicles. There's already proposals for UAVs that could use solar panels and never have to land. They could just stay in the air until they needed some form of maintenance. So until something breaks, they're fine.
In which case, they'd probably just crash.
Yeah. If there's enough of a warning where you know something's going to end up, or you just have, you know, a set schedule for when things need to have regular maintenance, then you might be fine. But if you get a note saying, oh, propeller failed, you're probably like, well, lost that one. But it's interesting because it could be used for all sorts of stuff. Not just, I mean, a lot of people sit there and think of surveillance, but that's not the only use. You can use it for things like sending it into a dangerous area that's been hit by a disaster or other sort of calamity and get a really good idea of what's going on before you send any kind of first responders in. Or in a example like the Fukushima nuclear reactor disaster, you want to be able to send in, you know, robots and that kind of stuff without having to put people in harm's way, because that's potentially a really dangerous situation. And having something that can maintain its position for a longer amount of time is more useful than something that just gets a snapshot. And then that's all, you know, the battery life is only 20 minutes or 40 minutes and then you have to fly it back. That's not as useful. Having something that can maintain its presence and keep an eye on developing situations is incredibly useful. So I think we're going to see that kind of technology more widely deployed over time as well. So I'm really, really excited by this project. I mean, I love any kind of engineering challenge where it makes people think creatively about how to solve these problems. So maybe in the future we'll do an episode about some of the amazing DARPA challenges too, like some of the ones that have incredibly difficult tasks that engineering teams have to figure out. How do they achieve these goals?
I like the problems that are specifically like this, where you're trying to squeeze every last drop of efficiency out of a mechanical system.
Sure.
Like the same way, I might not admire the way they drive in terms of safety reasons, but I like reading about the hypermilers, the people try to get every possible efficiency advantage they can out of their car.
Well, Joe, in an offline conversation that we had earlier this week, we've already determined that Mrs. Todd's shortcut is an interesting Stephen King short story about, you know, finding that most efficient route, even if it costs you your sanity. I agree. I mean, it's one of those things where you always think, like, there are those moments where you think, all right, we've hit it. We've hit the pinnacle. There is no squeezing a single ounce of efficiency more out of this.
Now, somebody then, smart can probably figure something out.
Yeah. Which is, that's always fantastic. I mean, cause again, we all stand to benefit. It might not be immediate. It might not be that the next day you wake up and suddenly the world is a magical place, but it could mean that another 5 or 10 years down the road, technology that we had not thought was possible is a mundane reality because of the things we learned from these engineering challenges. It's pretty cool. So yeah, I think, first, I want to say thank you, Joe, for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really love visiting tech stuff.
It's an honor. Oh, well, you know, the honors are all ours. And that wraps up this classic episode of Tech Stuff. Hope you enjoyed listening to it. If you have any suggestions for future topics I should cover or any, you know, topics that require an update or three, let me know. You can reach out on Twitter. The handle we use is TechStuffHSW. And I'll talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.